Welcome back to the Bastionland podcast, where we are exploring the rule of three. Each week I'll talk with a new guest about three tabletop games that are important to them. I'm Chris McDowell, and today I'm joined by the creator of Lichcraft, To Honor and Obey, and the upcoming Death Game. It's the undisputed bad boy of RPGs, Laurie O'Connell. Hello, Laurie.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for the appropriate introduction.
Well, I wasn't sure. Is there going to be a point where you level up from bad boy to, like...
bad man?
Like, evil man? Like, what's the next...
I think undisputed bad boy, I think I might have to, at some point there might be some disputes coming in that I would obviously have to deal with, but that would be the natural kind of plot progression, I think.
Yeah, if anybody disputes this via the podcast, I'll just send them your way.
Yes, tell them they can send me an email. We can book a time in to debate.
I love that the bad boy title is settled via debate and not like my title or anything.
Well, you know, in RPGs, there's not too much face-to-face contact going on sometimes. We can meet up at a con and figure it out in a gentlemanly manner.
That seems appropriate. So before we get onto your choices, without giving any of them away, how did you kind of decide on three games that were important to you? Was there anything you were particularly looking for in there, or did you just kind of pick the three that came to mind?
I was looking for games that really influenced my design mentality. And I thought it would be interesting because none of these games like really look much like the games that I write. Hmm. But they've kind of influenced the way that I think about games and the way that I think particularly about how, you know, we like human beings relate to games and how we relate to each other through them. So, and that's kind of always what I'm trying to explore in my design. If I was to give like a really, really broad mission statement, the kind of stuff that I write. So that's the kind of stuff that I picked.
Great. Well, there we go. We'll get on to the choices. So what have you chosen for your first game?
So the first game that I picked is Contract Bridge, which is an interesting one for a bad boy.
I was so glad when you chose this.
Yeah, well, I was listening and I didn't see a lot of card games.
Yeah, I think you're the first person to choose, I guess we'd call it a traditional game in the sense that something our grandparents could have played, I guess.
Yeah, and I like it for that. I think people need to understand that gaming has a thousand-year-long tradition, you know, and it's been something that we've kind of enjoyed together for a really long time, and Bridge is a really important part of that history for me.
And so what's your background with Contract Bridge specifically?
So it's a game that I played in school. My school had a bridge club and a chess club, and I thought that chess was too difficult. And Bridge had that kind of like element of chance. I started playing Bridge in school, also played it with my family kind of at home. I think a lot of people have that one kind of card game that they play with their family, whether it's Uno or, you know, Whist or Bridge or various other, you know, everyone's got like one family card game. And for our family, very ironically, it was Bridge. So I am the worst at it in my family as well by a very, very long way. Both of my brothers and my mum and my dad are much better at it.
Surely being like now the official game person in the family, I guess you should you would have thought you'd have like mastered it.
Yeah, I'm not actually that good at games. Like
better at making them than playing them.
I'm better at making them than playing them. Whenever there's a game that someone can win, I get really into it, right, and I lose my head. And, you know, I really struggle to think strategically because I really want to win very badly. I'm very competitive. So I'm not actually that good at games. Usually when I'm playing a board game with my family, the only way I win is by pretending I don't know the rules, and so they take pity on me.
That's valid.
Yeah.
Well, funnily enough, like you say that every family has like a card game, and I was trying to think like, well, what is it with my family? And growing up, we played a game. I've heard it called lots of games. We called it Blob, and it's it has some similarity to Contract Bridge, and it's essentially a trick-taking game, and you're trying to sort of like bid for how many tricks you think you can win. But I was looking through the rules for Contract Bridge ahead of this because I'd never actually played it. And I think there's a few weird wrinkles in there that I think are actually kind of cool from like a game design point of view. Things that you just don't see in like card games that were designed like in 2024. And one of the things that stood out to me, and I can't remember if we spoke about this previously, in every single round, someone is essentially sitting out. So I should say it's always four players, sorry. And it's two teams of two, isn't it, always? But how does the player sitting out, how does that work?
So, yeah, the way that Bridge works is you have two sets of partners, two teams of two, and you play like a round of whist, basically. You trick take and eat aces high. But before you start, you bid on trumps. So the trumps are the cards which are the most powerful, basically, in the game. Yeah. And only one set of partnership can win the bidding process. And that partnership that wins, it's the person that first bids trumps, what suit they wanted to be trumps, that actually plays the hand, and the other partner has to sit out. And that may seem like a really stupid mechanic, because why would you want someone sitting out? But I think it's because Bridge, like, at its heart is designed to be a game that you kind of play socially with friends, and someone goes and like makes gin and tonics, or like goes and gets snacks or something. And actually, Bridge culture is very kind of like rigid and polite these days, but it was also like a game that came out of like soldiers playing it during the Crimean War and things like that. That's where its kind of history is, as far as I understand it. So it makes sense from the like the social perspective, basically.
Yeah, like I say, it's these sort of strange things that feel like, if you're asking me to design a card game now, it feels like such an not even outdated, it just feels like a weird thing, in the same way that board games have moved away from like player elimination because it's not fun to sit out, or things like skip a turn. I'm not saying we should go back to all of those things, and I'm not saying every game should have an element where someone has to sit out, but you're completely right that these games that are very social, having that player sit out is interesting. And just having these games where I like a brain-burny card game or board game where you have to really think about it. But often, if I finish playing that game with a group of people, I feel like I've not spoken to them. And I think there's a real place for this kind of game that is almost like 50% game, 50% just an excuse to sit around the table. And like you say, whether it's drinking gin and tonics, or the other person's, you know, fetching sandwiches, or even just like they're leading the conversation, it feels like it's almost designed to create those kind of that kind of atmosphere.
Yeah, my mum always loves being dummy, because it's like a cigarette break. So you'll go, or like it's a bathroom break or something, and it's built in to be kind of acceptable to leave the table if you're the dummy, which I think is good. I think it makes sense. But ironically, actually, everything that we said about Bridge being a social game is completely thrown out of the window if you ever read a book of Bridge etiquette.
Oh, wow.
I think because Bridge has such social baggage and such a long like context, that's also why I wanted to bring it. So I have, not with me, but I have a book called like The Hoyle's Complete Card Game Guide or something.
I know it very well.
You know, the big green book?
Yeah, well, yeah. Mine's a big red book, but I think it's been around for ages. But I've got a copy somewhere about that.
Well, if you open up and you read the Bridge section, you'll be absolutely fascinated by it, because only a tiny corner of it is actually the rules. And then there's the text gets really small and they start talking about table etiquette.
Oh, wow.
And there's things like it is like considered impolite to pay insufficient attention to the game. That's one. You also shouldn't make a comment that might make somebody else at the table embarrassed. That's written into like the etiquette of the game.
Safety tools in Bridge.
Yeah, exactly. And there's also rules about, you know, it's impolite to touch your cards at certain amounts, and also to talk at the table. Particularly about the game. But obviously when you get up to kind of competitive Bridge, you can't talk at all.
Sure. Yeah, and I was in the version of the rules I was reading. Actually, I didn't get the book out. I thought I'll just find like a web page that explains it. Mm-hmm. And it was talking about bidding, and obviously the bidding that you do at the start, you're sort of bidding mm-hmm. for how many hands you think you can win as a team. Mm-hmm. And it said something to the effect of that, you know, when you've played a few times with the same partner, you are bidding to try and sort of give your partner a clue as to how good your hand is. Mm-hmm. Like if we're partners and I say, oh, I think we can win, you know, five extra hands on top of the seven, then you might think I have a really good hand. But it sort of implied that if you have an experienced team, you'll sort of develop like a secret language with your bidding. Like, is that a thing that you've encountered? So you can actually, you're bidding to bid, but you're also bidding to kind of secretly pass information to your partner?
Yes. So there's a rule in bridge which no information should be provided explicitly to your partner that the other team doesn't have. So, and that you're not allowed to provide it through any means other than bidding. So this is another thing that's so fascinating about the game, because the entire art of the game is in the bidding, which there are no rules for officially, but there are thousands of rules for unofficially.
Right.
So there are kind of conventions, they're called.
Okay.
So I don't know if you came up with any conventions in your reading.
I didn't see any specifics. No, it just sort of hinted at this great sort of metagame, I guess, that exists above that.
Yeah, so this is what's really interesting. So if I say one no trump, depending on what I've communicated, that if I start the bid with one no trump, for this is the simplest convention I know. Right. Depending on what I've communicated with my partner or not communicated with my partner beforehand, before I even start the game, I could be playing a weak no trump or a strong no trump.
Right.
So a weak no trump would mean my hand is pretty weak, like I've got, but it's strong enough that I think we could take more tricks, and I think we could be in a trump set, right? Mm. Which would mean I've maybe got 12 points and I'm asking my partner to pick a trump that they're strong in, right?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
But if I have a strong no trump bid, then I might say, actually my hand is strong, but it spreads pretty evenly. So it's still saying maybe pick something that you're strong in, but it's also saying maybe we could be in no trump. You know, it's a really complex system. And then, you know, there's these things called double overcalls and triple overcalls, which if you bid a certain number over what's already bid, it means something different. There's all sorts of conventions. I think there's a convention that if you bid three diamonds, it means something. Or two right. diamonds, it means, you know, these are things that my family are much better at than me, actually. They know all the conventions. It's a whole secret language. Like you said, all of the rules is in actually not written. They're not official rules, but everyone kind of knows them.
Yeah, and weirdly, it does feel like that's something we keep hearing about with RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
Like the game isn't necessarily about... The game can be about something that has a very small section of the rules, but when you actually start to play it, it actually becomes incredibly important. And likewise, when it's the actual playing of the game where you sort of discover what the game is. And yeah, it's interesting to see that in a way card games couldn't be further from RPGs, because they're extremely rigid and sort of structured, as opposed to being very free like an RPG. But the other thing that I really liked about this is it almost begs to be one of those games that you play, you know, once a week with the same people over and over again, mm-hmm. which is something I myself am very bad at doing, because I'm always chasing like the next thing or wanting to try something new. So I like that it sort of encourages that kind of mastery as almost a necessity, I guess, to sort of get to the core of the game.
Yeah, and I think... it does actually contain a lot of RPG language in it for all of the reasons that we've outlined, because it's social, because it's a game that you can play and there's kind of space for chatting and catching up with people, because it's a game that relies on communication, like even, and it's communication through almost a glass, right? Like through, you're not quite directly communicating with someone, but you're following a set of conventions and rules which enable communication. And because it has such a rich set of like unspoken rules and unspoken conventions, it all kind of mirrors RPGs in a really interesting way. it's definitely not a game that's up everyone's street, but it's a really interesting game to think about as a game designer, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I've been guilty before of sort of slamming these traditional card games because I, like I said, I've read through, well, I'm not from cover to cover, but I've read through a lot of entries in that book, the sort of Hoyle's collection. Mm-hmm. And I'll get frustrated because it feels like every game I start to read, it'll start with something like, okay, you play with a standard deck of card, but remove all the queens, sevens, and eights. And in this game, six is the highest, except for the Queen of Hearts, which is actually the highest. And you hit all these exceptions, and my brain just kind of like shuts down. So I think it's sometimes they're worth powering through. I mean, Contract Bridge, despite the fact we've made it sound very complicated, I think the core of it is pretty simple. I imagine you can sit down and play it, especially with an experienced partner, pretty readily. So yeah, it's something I think if you're interested at all in the full variety of tabletop games, it's definitely the sort of game that's fun to check out.
And there's, yeah, one more thing that I would add to that is, this is the important thing, I think, is that the reason why these card games seem so complicated is because they all have different families and genealogies, right? One card game will be invented on the basis of another card game. It will be invented on the basis of another card game. So they're like stacking different. So Bridge like seems really, if you start from just Bridge, it might be complicated. But if you've played any trick-taking game, then you already understand like elements of what it's about.
Yeah.
So you're not starting from zero. And, you know, games, for example, like the world in, as the world's changed, the games changed. Like, it was very rare before the French Revolution to play the ace above the king. After the French Revolution, it became very popular to put the ace above the king. So, you know, all of these things kind of add into the whole history of board games, which makes them seem more complicated than they actually are.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well, anyway, I'm gonna close this down because I feel like I could just talk about card games for the rest of this podcast if we're not careful. So yeah, we'll move on. So what have you chosen for your second choice?
The game that I picked for my second choice is Bluebeard's Bride, which is by Whitney Beltran and also Marissa Kelly and Sarah Richardson. All three of them are on the cover.
So quite the shift from Contract Bridge.
It's kind of the opposite.
Also a very social game in many ways, but yeah, very different feel.
There's no more cards.
No. So for those unfamiliar, what's the gist of Bluebeard's Bride?
Bluebeard's Bride is a classic kind of Powered by the Apocalypse game, but everyone, all the players play as the same character. And it's about the kind of the folk story of Bluebeard's Bride. So you play as this woman that has been married to kind of a mysterious pirate who has kind of left her alone in the house. And as you kind of explore the house, you uncover kind of these horrible secrets about your new husband, basically, and you have to kind of come to terms with the reality that your husband is a killer and is almost definitely going to kill you.
Have you played this multiple times or was once enough?
I've played it twice. Yeah. And I played it when I was kind of just getting into game design. And I found it really impactful in terms of the way that I thought about games and what they could do. And the fact, you know, you play as different kind of like mental facets of this woman. And what I think is so good about it is that it is not afraid to kind of explore like really, really dark and difficult themes. And the rules of the game kind of structure the way in which you encounter these themes. And you really do feel, if you're playing it right, you really do get this sense of like horror slowly dawning upon kind of the central character in the game. And it's very powerful, I think, as a way of describing these emotions.
Yeah, and the way that you play the same character is, my understanding is, it's essentially like you're playing almost different roles that that character would play, mm-hmm. like in that relationship and or in society, I guess, mm-hmm. Which I think is a really interesting way of putting it. Did you play different roles each time?
Yeah, I ran the game once. And then I played as, I don't remember which role I played as the second time. But I think, yeah, it's partially you're playing kind of different roles that this character kind of is forced in on in her life. Like, you've got this kind of, like, naive kind of element. You've got the more kind of, like, sexual side. You've got the kind of self-protective side. But I think it's also... To me, at least, I read it as the different kind of responses that people have to abuse.
Yes, yeah.
And the way that, you know, you might have multiple very contradictory thought processes going through your head. You might have, on the one hand, you might be really anxious, and on the other hand, you might be really angry. And, you know, very traumatic kind of events and relationships have a tendency to create these, like, you know, this is a feature of what trauma is, right? Creates these different, like, contradictory emotions and feelings and roles.
Sure.
And I thought an RPG which separates these out into different characters in a sensitive way was a really fantastic way of explaining that, actually.
Yeah, and I've seen other sort of indie games that have touched on this idea of, you know, you have one character the whole group shares. But this was the first one that I remember reading and thinking it just sort of immediately made sense. Mm. Like it sounds almost like a gimmick because it's like, oh, you all play one character. Mm. Sounds like almost like a novelty. But when you actually see how that's applied, like you say, it just feels like a perfect fit for how this character would be responding to this situation. And yeah, I think that's really well done. How would you say this has affected your own kind of design? Is this something that you've kind of... you can sort of see in your work as well?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, it was very eye-opening to me in terms of a relationship that I was in at the time. And then when I realized that through playing this game, I'd had kind of, not in the moment, but later I looked back on it and I thought, wow, that was a real epiphany moment about kind of how isolated I personally was feeling. And it wasn't didactic at all in the way that it kind of exposed these social relations and, like, modes of kind of manipulation and isolation. But it wasn't ever pushing that. It was just using the story to get the players to kind of come to these conclusions and draw out these themes on their own. And that's always something that I've tried to emulate in my game design. I try not to shy away from things that might feel sensitive just because it makes people feel uncomfortable. But I also think that what makes people feel uncomfortable in exploring sensitive subjects is not necessarily the subject matter itself. It's the feeling of, like, a didactic writer or game master pushing on you a specific way with which you have to understand that. So I've always tried to make my games like an invitation, right? Rather than like an open door, rather than a recipe for how you have to engage with kind of difficult or interesting or traumatic or complicated themes like religion or like death or spousal abandonment, you know.
And that's the thing with games, I guess. It's like, you know, it's a cliche, but the idea of, like, show, don't tell, something I always try to remember. But, like, playing a game is, like, a step further than showing, because it's like, I'm trying to think of a catchy phrase now because it would be great if I could think of it. But, like, instead of, like, show, don't tell, it's like, I can't think of the word. But, like, make them do it rather than showing them it. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're trying to get them to understand an issue or something, like, putting a player in there is even more powerful than, you know, showing them the thing. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. I think it's sort of one of the unique things of, you know, I know video games can do it as well, but I think RPGs especially can really tap into that.
Yeah, it's like it's invite, right?
Yes, that's a better way of putting it.
But it's also, the thing about Bluebird's Bride is not everyone is mature enough to engage with it. And actually, both times that I played it, I had people that reacted very badly to kind of the theming. Either because they were uncomfortable with what it might say about them, or because they just like weren't mature enough to engage in it. And I also found that like that was a big kind of moment for me as a games runner and also as a games writer, that not everything is for everyone. Like, you don't have to make something that anyone is going to have like the right maturity level or even want to play. You can make things that are catered towards specific people, specific outlooks on the world, specific levels of comfort, and that's a completely acceptable thing to do.
I guess it doesn't hide what it's about as well. Like I think I understand people who maybe underestimate how kind of far it goes into those themes perhaps, but I think it's, as with so many RPG things, it's about getting people on the same page at the start of the session, I guess, is the key. And I suppose with this one, it's even more key than if your game just has some scary monsters and you want to make sure everyone's prepared for that. This is kind of another level.
Well, you're deliberately getting people to put themselves in a place of discomfort because it's a meaningful part of the human experience. And it's a meaningful thing to want to explore through games. And I actually think it can be quite empowering, because the experience of abuse is usually an extremely isolating one. And how do you explore that? How do you explore that isolating like thing with other people, right? How can you collaborate in kind of picking apart that experience? I think it's potentially kind of very powerful. And maybe very healing if it's done in the right way and if it's done with kind of grace. But yeah, it is uncomfortable in a way that I don't think necessarily safety tools or a before table conversation can solve. But I think that's because, you know, a lot of people experience relationships like this, or a lot of people experience other situations like this, and everyone is going to have a different approach. And it's good to not ignore that when you're writing games. It's good to write some games that talk about this very meaningful, very important part of being a person that very often we kind of hide or try to shy away from.
And you know, people might think that they're ready to sit down and play this game, and then through the course of the game discover, oh, actually, this is stirring up things that I didn't necessarily realize were there. So I think you're right. I think I don't know what the answer is, but I think there's it's okay to, like you say, have some games be very challenging like this. But yeah, in terms of the safety tools, I don't know how I would run this. I don't know how many tools I could put in place that would make me personally feel comfortable running this. And this isn't a comment on the game. This is a comment on me feeling like I would feel confident enough to run it. And that doesn't make it a bad thing. It makes it a very challenging game. You know, challenging is neither good nor bad. It is what it is.
Yeah, and emotion is not a bad thing to have at the gaming table sometimes, if you're in kind of a place that you're able to deal with that, and if you're with people that you trust and you want to kind of have that situation with, right? Like, yeah, this game might invite strong emotions. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, it might cause people to kind of make associations with themselves. That's also not a bad thing. But yeah, it's complicated, and it made me realize that games could be a lot more than just like pretending to be someone for a while, which is always how I thought about role playing games before. And starting to make links to like the world, like the real world, and the way it might help us like process reality.
Did you have any final thoughts on Bluebeard's Bride before we move on?
Just to say, I actually don't design a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse games because I think they're really hard. So I was very impressed. Oh, that's another thing that really affected me as a game designer, actually. On getting away from the themes in Bluebeard's Bride for a minute, it is worth saying something that I really noted reading it is how carefully every single word is chosen in the game. Like, you can tell that in the process of writing it, they went over it with like a really close eye, and they thought, what word are we going to use for this skill. What word are we going to use for when this happens? And the language is very purposeful and intentional, and I think that's a very important and often missed part of game design.
So yeah, that's one that I, these are always, the people's choices are always kind of recommendations, but I think this recommendation comes with a look at it very closely before you decide how deeply you want to plunge into it. So what game have you chosen for your third choice?
The game that I chose is 6E by Snow, which is a much smaller and much more, I guess, ironic game that doesn't take itself as seriously as the other ones yes. that I've brought in, which is why I picked it.
It could be the smallest game that anyone's chosen in terms of just the actual word count.
I'm going for first today. I've got the first card game and the first smallest game.
So what is it about this game? Or rather, what's your sort of history with this game, I guess?
So it was the first game that I ever wrote a supplement for. Because okay. I wrote some new classes for me to play. And back in the day, during COVID, some friends of mine, like, we had like a little indie RPG like thing where we would go and we would play like a different random indie RPG every week that we would always get it off Itch. We'd just pick like something random from Itch and sure. we'd play it. And it was at that time in COVID where you could go to the pub, but you couldn't go to someone's house.
Right, yes.
So we would all like go to the pub and sit around this big table and we would like play these games. And we played 6E and we got so drunk while we were playing it. We had such a good time.
And are you sure this is the game and not the drink that was your choice?
Well, I think it's a game that invites silliness.
Sure, sure.
So and we had such a good time, and then we just stopped playing other indie games and we just started playing that. And it's not a game that rewards playing it for like playing the same character for a long period of time. So we'd do like a different, like one shot every week okay. or something. What I really liked about it was how it didn't take itself too seriously and it has like an immense flexibility. It's like everything that people write RPGs to solve, it just invites. And that's what I really enjoy about it.
And we should say, for those who aren't familiar with it, this is sort of a very short RPG. It is essentially, I guess, a generic system because there's not really any like setting in here. It just has some rules for, you know, having stats and how you sort of roll kind of task resolution. But they're kind of interesting. There's some interesting kind of wrinkles in there in terms of when you use a stat, it tends to change I forget which way around it is. If you succeed, the stat changes, doesn't it? So you rename the stat to like whatever you just did. So if you use strength to kick down a door, you have to rename strength as like breaking and entering or something, I guess.
Yeah, so this is what I found really interesting about the game, is that it's supposed to kind of make classes more specific as it goes, like almost randomly, like automatically generate kind of a specific sets of skills, because every time, yeah, like you say, if you persuade someone by flirting, you would have to rename your persuasion skill to flirting. Right?
Sure.
And then you might have to like go down that track for a while. But I thought that what was interesting is very immediately we all realized that. And we started trying to almost set up situations where we could get our skills back into kind of a manageable place.
Right, okay.
So, you'd have a skill that was like accurate, like pistol shooting or something like that. And then... in order to get back, you'd have to manufacture a situation where you shot your pistol really accurately to like break a lock so it could just become lock picking again, which is a much more sensible skill.
Yeah.
So it's a game that rewards meta play on such a deep level that the meta play is almost the entire of the game really is knowing how to like make it do things that make it a playable game.
And the thing I like about that is because my read through was, I kind of thought a similar thing to that. I thought when I tried to imagine it in play, I thought this is kind of going to lean into not quite a full on comedy game, but at least a game that has funny moments, which is most games in the end. But I think it does that without being overtly a comedy game when you read it. Like, it's not full of jokes, and like, it's not full of like weird like gag items and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of it's like you say, it's the way that the game works just creates, it sort of encourages those kind of funny moments and funny kind of stretches. And yeah, so my understanding as well is that by the end of the session, your character sheet will look radically different to how it looks at the start. Where did your character, well, it sounds like you played lots of different characters, but did you have a particularly memorable character in terms of how they ended up looking?
So I had a character that was a witch, and the witch class in 6e is that you need to marry people, and when you marry people, you gain their skills.
Right.
And the way that the whole situation went is that it just ended up being basically a gold digging campaign where she went around trying to marry people to gain their powers. So she ended up going from a pretty normal character to someone with like monk powers, like all sorts of crazy powers. And then at the end of the game, we ended up in a divorce court trying to figure out if a divorce meant that you could keep the powers or keep half of the powers, or if you had to give them all back. And so everyone's skills became really divorce law specific. it ended up being like this really niche like confrontation, and eventually someone had some kind of violence skill left, and it just turned into an absolute massacre in the divorce court. But that one really stuck with me because it went from being like a fantasy RPG to being like a dating simulator, to being like a legal. Like legal shenanigans, to going back to like a massive fight to the death again. So it shows you how like what crazy places this game could take you with such a small like thin rule set and no preparation whatsoever.
That's the other thing I was going to say, because it's I gather there was like a whole game jam around this, and there's been like people who've written like adventures and classes and stuff for this game, but just looking at like the core game book, there's like I say, I've always struggled with like generic game systems that don't have even a genre, really. I guess, you know, the fact that it's called 6e makes me think that you would want to run something close to D&D with it, but it's very open. So how did you go? Did you run the game, or were you just a player?
I ran the game, I played in it, and then eventually we started introducing a rotating GM situation where the minute one GM was like, fuck this, I can't run this anymore. What the hell are you guys doing? Someone else would have to take it over, and they could make a character, because it's impossible to prepare for, because the game, like, and the tone of the game shifts so much as the characters themselves shift.
I guess the prep you can do is just thinking about your players, because it's, again, the reason that I like it is I've read a lot of RPGs that try to be funny. And that's very hard to do. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it might be funny to one person, but not funny to another person. But what this kind of game does is it just opens up opportunities for your friends to be funny together.
Yeah.
And presumably that's the humor that you like, or at least you've learned to tolerate over years of being friends with these people. So it's in a way, it's a much more effective way of making a game funny, rather than trying to, as the author, like fit all your jokes into the group. Mm. But yeah, it's I was surprised how much I liked it, because when I realized it was like a generic system, it wasn't tied to a particular setting and it didn't really have any sort of adventure in it or random tables, I sort of thought, what would I do? But I think you're right, it is that opportunity to just open it up to the table and just almost let the primordial soup of the table kind of form the setting.
I think that is what it is. It's so I think it's very unique in the amount of creativity. Obviously, all games, you can say, oh, this game is really about creativity and storytelling and all of that. But it really takes kind of all of the crutches away. And also then you realise what of the crutches and maybe kind of barriers as well. And I think it's obviously not necessary, it doesn't give everything that other games give, right? It doesn't give you the setting, it doesn't give you, in fact, if you start with an adventure, you're very likely not to be able to actually finish that adventure.
Yeah.
But I think it's really special in its own way, and it just shows how you can write rules for fun and creativity, and they don't have to be so complicated, and they can be flexible.
Awesome. So yeah, that's one you can check out. That's 6E by Snow. Looking at those three choices, we touched on this a little bit at the start, about what sort of connects them and how they've kind of influenced your games that you've designed and sort of your kind of journey as a designer. Are there any honourable mentions you wanted to sneak in there?
I actually wanted an honourable mention for Pendragon.
Oh, I know that we've spoken about this theme overall, but I didn't know. What's your actual experience with Pendragon itself?
I have played it for, I don't remember which edition that I played, but I played it when I was in high school.
Okay.
For a campaign, and it didn't last a super long time, like, I'm not going to lie, the campaign. But I've also read the book, and as someone that loves history, really deeply enjoyed the book and also been extremely enraged by it.
Oh, wow.
And you know what I love about it? I love the rollable tables for things that really shouldn't be rollable tables. That's something. I love the there's the edition that I read. You could roll for like miscarriages.
That was the one that immediately jumps to my mind. The childbirth table is. I don't want to say it's hilarious because that makes me sound like a horrible person, but it's hilarious that it exists within an RPG. Yeah.
Yeah. So roll to see if your wife dies and if your kids die. There's a rollable table for how if another knight discovers that you're sleeping with his wife, like how he's going to respond to that as well. Yeah. And it's something that I actually kind of go back to, because a lot of the stuff that I write is almost like my answer to the way that typical Arthurian RPGs are kind of done. But that doesn't mean I don't appreciate them for what they are. And even the miscarriage table makes sense if you think about it's kind of partially a lineage building game, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's like, so I've not played a long Pendragon campaign. I've played a few sort of one shots of Pendragon, and that's the stuff that excites me, is that long term play and the specificity of feeling like, yeah, we're in a medieval world, so childbirth is this, you know, very dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. And it's good that's represented. It sounds bizarre to describe it, you know, alongside something like D&D or whatever, or the very lighthearted lockpicking pistol shooting game that we were describing a few minutes ago. But I think for me, it's the thing that shines about Pendragon is, I always wonder that if Pendragon didn't exist, how many other things wouldn't exist? Because it kind of feels like a real landmark moment for specificity and just going in really hard on one concept for an RPG that I hadn't really seen before then.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree that it kind of is one of those ones that it has its ups and downs overall, but I think it's a really important one.
I think that it's a well-written game, and the unfortunate side of it is that it combines the social baggage of the time in which it was written in kind of the RPG world, and particularly a specific perception of women.
Yeah.
Which, with that baggage in Arthuriana as well, which is a trap, right? And like that was never going to be something that would age well, to put it lightly.
It's a difficult one, because I guess we've spoken very briefly about this, about gender in games before, and I think my sort of stance on it is, you either need to do it really well or kind of not do it, rather than do a kind of middling job of addressing it. And I feel like Pendragon at least tried to go hard on it and say, we're going to represent it. But it's kind of trying to have its cake and eat it a little bit, because it's saying it's historical, but also it's leaning into the myth side of things and like including some of the misconceptions and things.
Well, and it's changed throughout editions as well. Like, there were some early editions that were very much like, there are two kinds of women in this world. And they're like the ones that have the ones that have the children and are your wife, and they're going to be the ones that serve you in pubs. And I don't remember if that's the exact phrasing, but it was very much like that. And then over time, it's kind of developed, but it hasn't quite managed to kind of shake off all of this baggage. But it doesn't. The complicated thing is that when you're talking about a historical or like a semi-historical or pseudo-historical game, you obviously shouldn't just ignore like the social context.
No, yeah. If you're setting it in a historical period, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm talking more about ignoring it in sort of a. Ignoring is perhaps the wrong word, but being much more sort of taking it out of the spotlight, I guess, and just sort of letting people apply their own positions on it.
Yeah, I think what could have been really interesting with Pendragon, and maybe what they will do in future editions, is like rather than necessarily saying, oh, you know, we can kind of ignore or like paper over these gendered divisions, and we can ignore like the very precarious position of women in the Middle Ages, like, and in the Dark Ages. You could pay some more attention to what's going on at home, right? You could make the lineage building aspect of it into something that rewards active play. You know, you could have players also play as their wives.
You could
take that out of the realm of rollable tables and make it a part of the game, or make it, you know, an expansion or a secondary aspect, rather than just kind of like taking it out altogether. But it's very interesting, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about how I would do it, and I know that I personally, were I to be writing the game, would not be able to do it in a way that would please absolutely everyone.
Sure, yeah.
But I think that the problem is, you know, if you try and please everyone, you do end up pleasing absolutely no one at all. So
that's it. Yeah. And have you read Saga of the Icelanders?
I have not, no.
That's one that would be interesting, because it's a Powered by the Apocalypse game that is obviously based on Saga of the Icelanders, so Vikings and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that has very clear, I don't want to say the whole game is about like gender roles, but it's a huge part of that game. Mm-hmm. And they're almost treated like character classes, not even like different character classes, but your gender almost affects how you engage with the game, and you're almost playing two different games depending on your character. So that it can be done. I haven't seen the most recent edition of Pendragon, so I'll be interested to hear if you do ever dip into it, whether it meets the standard.
I think they've just gone more over to the side of like, you know, you can have knights that are women. I'm not against female knights, by the way, but you know, it's they've had to depart a little bit from the Arthuriana kind of source material in order to make the game more accessible, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think Pendragon will slip in there as a. You keep saying that you're achieving firsts. That's like the longest honourable mention. So you've kind of snuck in four rules. You've broken the rule of three.
I'm sorry.
Really, the boy. You've broken the rule at the heart of this entire format.
I'm very sorry. I knew that if I mentioned it, you'd probably
say sorry.
I knew that if I mentioned it, you'd probably be really interested in it as well.
Yeah, you got me.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing your choices with us. Where can people go if they want to find out more about your stuff?
So I have a website where I publish all my books, which is 12pinspress.com. 12 with letters, not numbers. I have a Twitter, which you can follow if you must, Laurie_EEE. And on my website, you can find all my links, like you can find my newsletter, which I would really encourage anyone listening to sign up to, and everything else like that.
Thank you to Laurie for joining me, and thank you everyone for listening. As always, you can keep up to date with everything Bastionland at bastionland.com, where there are links to the Discord server, YouTube channels, and to Patreon, where you can help support this podcast. And you can join me next week. I'll be welcoming a more well-behaved guest to distill their gaming history into the rule of three. Goodbye for now.